Yeah, so I'm going to talk about the role then of nuclear stellar clusters in the formation and growth of supermassive black holes. So I'm really going to consider two questions. I'm going to keep the time, but I'm going to do two questions here. How can supermassive black holes form and grow so quickly at high redshift? We've heard quite a lot about that already today, of course, but that's a challenge in a sense to make massive quasars out at redshift 6 or 7 or so. So I'm going to think about that a little bit. But also I'm going to ask kind of an opposite question, actually, which is how can some galactic nuclei avoid making supermassive black holes altogether at all, right? So I want to begin with number two, actually, just to remind everyone. This is M33, it's local. It's a spiral galaxy, no bulge in here. M33 really doesn't have, it doesn't seem to have at least, a supermassive black hole in the middle. So something has not happened here that's led to a not black hole here. It's probably that rather than some big merger ejecting the thing, because a big merger tends to make a big bulge because we stir up and starburst and all the rest of it. And this is bulge-free. You can see there's not much in there, right? So there's no supermassive black hole even today, but there is a nuclear stellar cluster in the center of this thing. So I'm going to talk a little bit about nuclear stellar clusters and a bit about cluster dynamics, actually relates very much to what we heard just a moment ago from Stein, and then come back to answer my two questions. So nuclear stellar clusters, the words tell you what they are. They're stellar clusters right in the nucleus of a galaxy. So they're not clusters in their own right, moving around, orbiting a long way away, but they're right in the middle. And this plot here, observational plot, is log of mass in solar masses, so there's 10 to the 6, 10 to the 8. And this is log of surface density, so good observer plot here, solar masses per square parsec. And I'm not sure what you can see from the back, but there's the globular clusters are here. And these squares, if you can see the squares, hopefully some of you can, are sort of at the more massive end of the globular clusters. They're the nuclear clusters. So if you want to think about a nuclear stellar cluster as a beefy globular, okay, a more massive globular cluster, that's a pretty good first approximation. Okay, they have masses of 10 to the 6 upwards, and they're a little bit larger. They have radii maybe up to 10 or so, 20 parsecs. But they're fundamentally a more massive version of a globular cluster with a higher velocity dispersion in most cases, as we'll see. So this is my model of a nuclear stellar cluster. I want to emphasize here that this is not the halo of the galaxy. This is the halo of my nuclear stellar cluster. So this object here is, again, only perhaps 10 or 20 parsecs across. But I want us to think a little bit about, very simply, what's going to go on in this object. We have two places in my cluster. We have the core, and we have the halo around it. Again, this is the whole of the stellar cluster. Tunus is the theme of this talk. Okay, two key ideas here. Scattering between stars transports energy within a cluster. So to be clear for everyone, what I mean by that is a star is here, it's at rest, it's not doing anything. Another star comes along, they pull on each other, and now they're both moving. So this star was not moving, now is moving, it's gained energy. So scattering between stars transports energy within a stellar cluster. The other funny thing about self-gravitating systems, so a system held together by its own gravity, is that they have a negative heat capacity. This negative is weird and important, that's why it's in a non-black color here. What do I mean by that? Well, let's imagine this pen has a negative, this is going to get a bit strange, this laser pointer has a negative heat capacity. What would that mean? Let's imagine I could somehow stick it in a microwave oven and heat it up so I could barely hold it, right? Okay, I'm barely holding it. Over time, it would lose energy and cool. Yeah, makes sense, okay, and I could now hold it properly. But if this had a negative heat capacity, as it lost energy, it would get hotter, and because it's hotter, it would lose energy even more quickly. That's what's going on in the core here. Because what's happening is we imagine the core made up of just a massive thing and a planet going around it, just because it's easier on our brains at 5 in the afternoon. If I take the planet going around the star, think of the heat as the speed of the planet, and something comes along and I scatter the something coming along, and it takes some energy away. My planet then is more bound to the central object, right? It's going around more quickly. So in that sense, my self-gravitated system, my core, has got lots of things going around each other in a complicated way, but it's the same idea. When I extract energy from that core, a star comes in from the halo on a radial orbit, scatters, gets a bit of energy, the core stars get closer together, they're moving more quickly. They've lost energy, they're more bound, but they're moving more quickly. They're hotter. And because they're hotter, they can lose energy more quickly. So what can happen in this situation is something called the gravithermal catastrophe, which essentially is that runaway collapse. The core gets hotter and hotter, denser and denser, and we can potentially go through what is called core collapse in the cluster. What that means for us then is the core gets very dense. We can potentially have then, if I have balls of gas in there, have a runaway situation where my collision time is short compared to evolutionary time of those objects, so I could potentially build up a massive object in the middle, for example. And that's one way to potentially make an intermediate mass black hole in young clusters, which I'm not going to talk about today, actually. But you get the idea of core collapse. Whoops. So there's really a competition then in my cluster between two processes. The energy loss, which I've just described for you, leading to core collapse. But there's also energy sources within a stellar cluster, apart from just simply scattering. If I have binaries, so imagine I have a binary, so two stars in a binary, and a third star comes along, providing the binary is hard, it has more binding energy than the incoming kinetic energy, something complicated happens, and typically I eject a star and the binary gets a little bit harder. That's an enormously important energy resource, a fossil fuel in a way, in our stellar cluster, because you use them up. Okay? So you have these binary single encounters can heat the cluster, and that's an extra source of heating, so it can prevent or at least delay the core collapse. So probably that's what's going on today in most globular clusters, at least a lot of globular clusters. Our cluster cores have got somewhat dynamically evolved, but at the moment, binary single heating is still taking place in globular clusters today. Now, there's another thing to think about, which is the following. Imagine I have my globular cluster, for the sake of argument, a stellar cluster where my binary heating is going and I'm all in nice equilibrium and I'm gradually evolving, but I'm not core collapsing. And now let's imagine I go, and I shrink the whole cluster by a factor of 100. Okay? Now, the smart people in the room will say, well, that doesn't make any difference because gravity is scale-free, which means that the scattering and the heating is all the same. That's actually not true because we have big G and C in the problem. Because if my binary shrinks, what can happen is I get gravitational radiation in spiral, and that goes horribly as a sensitive function of separation. The time scale for two objects to merge by gravitational radiation scales as separation to the fourth power. So if I can take a situation where my binary is now shrunk, what can happen is the buggers can merge as they radiate away gravitational radiation before they get to heat the cluster. So we've got two body scattering, we've got binary single heating, and we've got the idea that tight binaries will merge by gravitational radiation. So three things to remember. Now, okay, let's go back now to the second question first. Make logical sense here, M33. What's going on in M33? Why is it that M33 didn't make a black hole? Remember, that was the galaxy with no bulge, no supermassive black hole. Well, the idea that Cole and I, we wrote up last year is the following simple idea, really. If we take a stellar cluster, because the stars that are in binaries, like the Sun, main sequence stars in binaries have a finite size, if I have a cluster with a velocity dispersion about 40 kilometers a second, then black holes can form there because the primordial binaries can't support the cluster against core collapse. You can imagine if I have a cluster with a higher and higher velocity dispersion, I need tighter binaries to give me the energy because everything's going up, right? But tighter binaries, at some point, I hit the finite size of the stars. The binaries are literally so tight that they can't fit. The stars can't fit in the binary. They merge because they have some eccentricity. And we showed that the barrier, that the limit between us, is a velocity dispersion of the cluster about 40 kilometers a second. So that says the following. If I have a cluster, a nuclear stellar cluster, with a dispersion of about 40 kilometers a second or higher, providing I can wait long enough for the relaxation process to happen, we really think core collapse is inevitable because regular stars in binaries can't support it. Okay? That's really confusingly put for the M33 likes because you say, mate, the M33 doesn't have a black hole. Well, that's because in M33, the velocity dispersion is not above 40 kilometers a second. It's about 25. Okay? So in M33, it's like a bigger version of a globular cluster then. The dynamical evolution is happening, but the binaries are still burning, supporting the core against core collapse. And you haven't had core collapse, you've not made a black hole. That's the idea. Now I want to go back to redshift 12. I want to talk about, before I finish, making supermassive black holes at high redshift. But I'm going to think about the same idea here. It doesn't exclude other ideas, but the idea I'm going to explore today is simply the following. Let's imagine I have some galactic merger, and I'm pouring a lot of gas into the middle of the galaxy really quickly, as we saw this morning. But let's imagine that it just happens that the thing that's doing the merging happened to have a nuclear stellar cluster in there already. Just going to explore that idea. In reality, it won't be that simple, right? What will happen is you'll be pouring gas in with bits of stars and all sorts at the same time. But let's imagine we just simply have a nuclear stellar cluster and I pour in lots of gas. That's the idea, okay? So what can we do then? Well, imagine I have a nuclear stellar cluster and I pour lots of gas. So the gas mass is significant compared to the stellar cluster mass. It's larger. What will happen, actually, if I pour lots of gravitational binding mass but not much angular momentum, you will shrink the cluster. Some of you may know, if you know about binary evolution, if I have a star emitting a wind, the binary gets wider. This is kind of the opposite problem. I'm adding mass. So the cluster will shrink. So by adding mass, by pouring mass into the nuclear stellar cluster, I contract and I increase the velocity dispersion. Okay? And here I'm talking about the Lucio's work that shows with others you get this big mass in for. Now, at that point, my velocity dispersion goes up and binaries can no longer support the cluster, which undergoes core collapse. Because I've increased the velocity dispersion, a lot of the binaries are broken up because things are moving more quickly, and the ones that survive are much smaller now. And again, as you learned before, if I shrink the binaries, they start merging by gravitational radiation. So imagine I have two black holes or a black hole neutron star stellar mass black holes in binaries. They will merge by gravitational radiation now, and now they're merging. Now, this is when it gets interesting. If you're paying attention to Stein's talk, and I'm sure you all were, one of the big take-homes from that talk is that when I merge a black hole with another black hole, or maybe a neutron star, I get this recoil kick, right? Gravitational radiation recoil kick, because the merger time, the time for something interesting to happen at the very end, is always less than T orb. So I shine all my gravitational waves that direction, and I get a recoil. Those recoil kicks are quite large. They're hundreds of kilometers a second. So in a regular globular cluster, that's a problem, right? Because the escape speed in a globular is a few times the velocity dispersion, perhaps 40, 50 kilometers a second. So if I make lots of binaries and start merging them in a globular, I just kick them all out. It's very hard, at least, to retain them. But what happens here? Here we have a coincidence. So this is a log of time versus log of velocity dispersion in units of 10 kilometers a second. Sorry. We start here, regular globular clusters at zero here, right, because the velocity dispersion is typically 10 kilometers a second. And I have two time scales here. I have the time scale, the time scale here to merge by gravitational radiation, and the time scale here to heat. So I'm looking at a particular binary, a moderately hard binary, and I'm asking the question, given that binary, how quickly does that binary heat other stars in the cluster? That's my dotted line. And how long does it take to merge? So you can see in a globular cluster, my useful binaries are going to merge by gravitational radiation in about 10 to the 18 years. That's why we don't talk about it there much. They're merrily heating away the globular cluster on a timescale of about a billion years. But now let me pour all the gas into the stellar cluster. My velocity dispersion goes up. I move along the line here. I move somewhere about here. Two things have happened that matter. My gravitational radiation in spiral is now less, it's shorter than my heating, which is what I told you before, so my binaries are going to merge, one. Two, I avoid getting Steined. Steined means I get kicked out of my cluster, because now my velocity dispersion here, this is a log scale in units of 10 kilometers a second, sorry, this is about 300 kilometers a second. So actually, by a fluke in a way, the conditions that make my binaries merge before they heat also mean that the merge products get retained inside my cluster, because my velocity dispersion and in turn my escape speed is larger than the kick they get. Get it? This matters for us because it means that the black holes and the neutron stars, when they merge, stay put pretty much in my core because the velocity dispersion is higher. So what's the bottom line then? The bottom line is that the tight binaries merge but are retained due to this business of the higher velocity dispersion. And because they merge and they stay put, then I have two 10 solar mass black holes makes 20. It goes marauding around, exchanges into another binary, it merges and off we go. And we have some runaway process then where we build up some seed black hole. Interesting point then, very quickly, we do all this in a dark way, right? We're not really Eddington limited at all because we're merging black holes, but even the neutron stars, because very quickly, a 50 solar mass black hole would swallow neutron stars whole. And in turn, once we build up to perhaps 100 or 1,000 solar masses, we also can eat white dwarfs whole as well. We tidally shred them inside the black hole, if you will. So we can build up potentially quite a massive object this way, certainly interesting in the same way that a quasistar is, right? And then if we can do that at sort of redshift 11 or 12 in exactly the same way as the quasistar picture, then we can potentially get up to the billion solar mass quasars at redshift 7. So really, what's the next step? So the idea then was basically we had a stellar cluster in situ, we just poured the gas in. It's a very simple idea to describe what's going on, and it's a reasonable picture. But what we want to do, I think, the next natural step is the following, which looks, I have to say, rather biological picture here. That's like a heart with blood vessels or something. But this is actually a simulation from these guys, Davide and Lucio here. And what we have here is a cosmological simulation, and you can perhaps see the length scales here. This is 1,000 kiloparsecs h^-1 along there. And this is a cosmological simulation, redshift 5, structure forming, galaxies merging at these two points, M3 and M4. And the nice thing, the really beautiful thing with these simulations they're doing now, is if we zoom in on that M3, then you can see stuff and stuff here merging again on the length scale here, 20 kiloparsecs, h^-1. And zooming in further, you can really see these little dots here. Dots are real. What they are forming stellar clusters. So what these guys can now do, which is rather nice, is in their simulations actually make stellar clusters in the gas that's falling in. So our next logical step then is to look at all this gas going into the center of the galaxy, but also thinking about the stellar content made as it goes in and looking at that in a little bit more detail. Right. So let me just summarize. Gas inflow into nuclear stellar clusters can accelerate the black hole formation at high redshift. Pour the gas into a nuclear stellar cluster, make it shrink, make the binaries merge and retain them. Black hole formation is inevitable probably in nuclear stellar clusters if our velocity dispersion is high enough because the binaries can't heat us. That may take a while though without the gas falling in, but it seems inevitable. And then in M33 then the velocity dispersion is too low so the binaries can still heat you and then potentially avoid making a supermassive black hole. Thank you.
Questions?
So, I don't think you're getting rid of the seed black holes we were talking about this morning. Those could be for the very high mass black holes at high redshift. But what you're saying, I think, is that you could make all the rest of them, all of the lower mass.
Well, there's two. The question is when we want to make them. I think if we just have a nuclear stellar cluster and leave it alone, so at the very low velocities, they never make anything. The moderately higher velocities, on their relaxation time, they go to core collapse. But that could easily be quite a long time. I think if you want to make them early in this way, then you take that stellar cluster and pour lots more gas into it, and you do that at high redshift. And the pouring gas into it event we need is then the same event that Lucio and others use to make their quasi-star. Right? That would be my point. So if we have you could potentially, at least, if you have a big enough stellar cluster already there in situ, or at least falling in with you, you could potentially do it this way as well, even at high redshift.
So coming back to M33 type object, some of an additional to this sort of process, which is likely preventing the formation, you're also saying that these sites have to have very quiet merging history. So
that's
they
right.
could not have yeah. acquired.
No, that's absolutely right, yeah.
Right.
No, that's
so
a fair point. That's quite
you're saying
point.
Something yeah. about the merging history of M33 as well as the internal dynamics, right?
No, that's absolutely correct. So, for example, yeah, so it's an interesting question, right? So, obviously, for example, making a nuclear stellar cluster is a natural thing to do. If I just make a galaxy on its own and make lots of massive clusters, so we'll think of them as globulars, but they'll be in the disk, then people have shown, in fact, there's papers out very recently, I mean, over many years, people have looked at the idea that the massive ones will sink, and you will form a nuclear stellar cluster just from clusters merging. But you're quite right, if another thing comes along and I have a moderately major merger with a black hole in that thing, that will often at least end up in the middle, of course. That's absolutely correct. But it's significant here, I think, this really is classified as a bulge-free galaxy, and we can see that there really isn't a bulge in here. So in this case here, we've got good evidence, at least, that this has not had at least a very major event, because we would expect, again, to get lots of star forming going and leave a bulge, right? Right. So for example, there's also NGC 205 is an example like that. So if you look at the nuclear stellar clusters or these objects in general, a lot of things have, I mean, this is a velocity dispersion of 25, and our limit is around 40, and that's really quite low. I mean, these really are slightly more massive versions. To remind everyone, most globules are between 10 and 20, give or take, kilometers a second. So this is really very low velocity dispersions for a galactic nucleus.
Okay, I'm afraid we are running out of time, so we really need to move on. Thanks again.
Thank you.